This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is National Rural Electric Cooperative Association CEO, Jim Matheson. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NRECA's Jim Matheson next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's Crop Insurance Industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. In the 1930s, the nation's rural residents used their own dollars to form cooperatives and bring electricity to the underserved of the nation. Today, those cooperatives are in 48 states, serving over 42 million customers. NRECA CEO Jim Matheson says the war on coal and other regulation from Washington providing headwinds to meet the growing demand for power in rural America.
Well, clearly there's been a lot of different factors that are affecting how we make electricity in this country. Some of it's on the policy side in terms of what's allowed or not allowed. Some are market forces too. You know, this country, through the technology called fracking, has also accessed a lot of natural gas, and there's a lot more gas-fired electric generations that have been built in the last 15 years, and it's changed the fuel mix for co-ops. The good news is we've maintained our fleet of plants in a way where we believe we can reliably serve our consumers. But our concern about a reliability of the grid is on a going forward basis. There is this public policy movement to take fossil fuel plants offline. And what we claim is that what we like to point out as the problem with that is those are plants that are always available 24/7, 365, right? And renewables, which can have a role as part of a portfolio of electric generation, but the sun doesn't shine 24/7 and the wind doesn't blow 24/7. So we've got to make sure as a country we're not shifting away from always available generating capacity to sometimes available generating capacity, because it sounds pretty clear that doesn't work all the time. And in America today, we're increasing our electrical use. The economy's growing. We see increased electrification of a lot of industries. So demand is going up. The worst thing we can do right now is take more of our existing capacity offline where supply goes down. And that's where the policy world is taking us these days. So I can tell you, as America's Electric Cooperatives is a national association, we've been very aggressive in raising these issues about make sure you assign appropriate value to these always available generating plants. And quite frankly, what's always available? It's going to be coal. It's going to be natural gas. It's going to be nuclear. Those are the plants that are there 24/7.
Some of the recent data that I had seen suggests that over 60% of the electric generation of the country is from a fossil fuel, either natural gas or coal.
That's a pretty good estimate, yes, for the country in general. About 20% is nuclear. And like I said, I'm not saying renewable energy can't be a valuable part of a broad portfolio of generation. It can come in at a really low cost at times and be a valuable part of that portfolio. But at the end of the day, the backbone of the system is what's always there. It's all about reliability. You know, it's interesting in this country. We all have this expectation in this country. Anytime you flip the switch, you expect the light to go on. And we should never take that for granted. That's actually a pretty special thing we have in this country. There are a lot of countries in the world this day where that's not the case. Let's not go backward on that great track record we have in America of having a reliable electric system.
I saw a quote recently from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation suggesting that two-thirds of the U.S. could face energy shortfalls in the heat of this summer. Do you agree?
Yes. Yes, this organization you referenced, which their acronym is NERC, their job is just to assess the reliability of the electric grid in this country, and they publish a summer and a winter report every year. And the summer report for summer 23, they said yes, just over two thirds of the country is at elevated risk for outages And they've been publishing this report, and for the last 5 years, the risk of outages has been growing every year. And by the way, I just have to mention, this is not theoretical. Just last year on Christmas Eve, we had rolling blackouts in 9 states in the Mid-Atlantic area, from Virginia down to the Carolinas and over to Mississippi. 9 states had rolling blackouts because a cold snap came in, and there wasn't enough natural gas in the pipelines to make enough electricity to keep the lights on. So we've got to be thoughtful about this as a country. We do not want to go down this path where we're shutting down more of these always available plants and put us at greater risk.
So is the electric grid, the base load today, ready for a higher volume of electric vehicles?
Well, you're asking a great question. Higher volume of electric vehicles and other new uses of electricity. You know, we keep building new data centers every day. Boy, those use a lot of electricity, too. And the grid, and I'll use it in the broader definition of the grid, both the generation sources and the transmission grid, it's at the breaking point. We need to be investing in making sure we have adequate generation and also adequate transmission to get that electricity to where it's needed. And we can do it. This country has a record of over 100 years of building an electric grid that's a pretty remarkable asset today, but we got to maintain that asset and build into it. And that leads to one other impediment to that I should mention. That is, boy, it's hard to build something in this country this day. It's hard to get a permit to site something. Again, whether it could be a coal plant, a gas plant, it could be a solar farm or a wind farm, or it could be a new electric transmission line. It's really hard to build anything these days. And we need to have a more rational approach to how we assess if a project should or shouldn't be built. And I get that they shouldn't be built everywhere. I think we do need a good environmental review of a project for impact, but you got to have it over a defined period of time and not let it drag out for several years. And to give a thumbs up or thumbs down, let's go or let's not go, we got to reform the way we permit building new facilities in this country.
Agriculture and other groups have made a call for infrastructure, roads, bridges, railways. Lord knows the inland waterway system, the locks and dams are long overdue. But I don't hear much conversation at all about improving the generation side of electricity or improving the transmission side of the industry. But I do hear a lot of talk about increasing demand.
Yeah, you're right about this. Maybe it's because we take it for granted because our system has worked so well for so long. But I'm here to tell you, those of us in the industry recognize that we gotta continue to invest in that infrastructure to make sure we can meet these increased demands of the future. It's so critical to the functioning of this country and so critical in rural America in particular, where, by the way, let's remember, a lot of our manufacturing base in this country is in rural America. I know the products may get consumed in the urban areas, but we make a lot of stuff in rural America, and electricity is key to maintaining that manufacturing base. We don't want to take actions to put that at risk.
So let's drift over to this new responsibility that has being shouldered by a number of co-ops, and that of rural broadband. Let's start with assessing the situation. Are the FCC maps now an accurate representation of service and speed in rural America?
Well, the Federal Communication Commission has a long history of having, they rely on these maps that are broken out by what are called census blocks and say, well, this area has good broadband and this area doesn't. And there's a long history of those maps have been pretty bogus. They've relied on existing incumbent providers in the area who may be offering dial-up on copper wires and said, oh, we got this area covered, so it's okay. And the FCC would accept that as saying, well, they don't need any investment in broadband. I think we've made some progress. I think enough people have pointed out that these maps were really not accurate of the needs in rural America, and the FCC's gone through a new process to redo maps. They published a new group of maps, and you could challenge if you disagreed with us on the map, and I think we're moving in better directions. The maps are not perfect today. I just want to be real clear about that. But I do feel like, based on a lot of people saying we got to do better than we've been in the past, I think we're moving in a better direction. So hopefully that makes good decisions about where public money goes, because we want to make sure it goes to the right place.
I've presented this question to a number of people in the know, and I offer it for you now. There are a lot of agencies and a lot of money being pushed toward rural broadband. But is there a central plan, or is it uncoordinated government chaos?
Well, maybe it's somewhere in between. There's more than one entity. There's more than one place that has funds for this. And I do think that the maps, to the extent they're valuable, can serve as a more of a coordinated function about where resources should go. And so I do think we're moving in a better direction, but I don't want to overstate that there's no problem here. You're right. You've got different agencies that are funding broadband different ways. I happen to think an agency that's really critical, and that happens to be the Department of Agriculture, who understands rural America better than any of these other federal agencies. They understand the needs of it, and from a utility standpoint, they've already been funding both telephone and electric cooperatives for years in rural America. So I really think the Department of Agriculture represents the best view of how to deploy broadband in rural America.
Well, it just so happens that there is the writing of a new farm bill, hopefully here in 2023. There was a hearing on broadband in Washington recently, and one of the folks who testified was Jim Matheson. What did you have to tell them, and what are the points that are critical, perhaps, that could surface in a farm bill, either with a direct focus on where spending needs to take place, or the coordination of spending in particular areas to get the most bang for the buck?
Well, first of all, I said I emphasize the importance. I think the Department of Agriculture is the best shot at us making good decisions for rural America on broadband. I said if we're going to do this, let's make sure that we do it in a way where we're investing in real broadband that is what we call future-proof. And what does that mean? We need real speed. You know, we all know that the need for speed and upload-download speeds for broadband, it's changing all the time, right? Let's not use outdated speeds. Let's put a requirement of at least 100 megabits up, 100 megabits down is the minimum for if Department of Agriculture is going to fund any rural broadband. Now, that's an aggressive move that we've taken on our position. Other interests think speed should be lower. We disagree. I'm sure you've had other guests on your show talk about this advent of precision agriculture, which is such an exciting opportunity for the agricultural sector. But that precision agriculture requires both upload and download speeds for the data to make it work. So we were real clear. One of the strongest points we made when I testified in front of the House Agriculture Committee for this next farm bill is require speeds at this higher level is the minimum to invest public dollars, because we don't want to be turning around 5 years from now and saying, uh-oh, that stuff we did is already out of date, and we got to spend more money to update it. So I think that's a really important point we made. And finally, I think at the end of the day for broadband in rural America, we want to make sure that if somebody's got they're providing service at lower speed, some people on the committee are saying, oh, we shouldn't build there. We should go just where it's unserved. And I said, wait a minute. I think everybody in rural America should have access to real broadband. I don't like it when I hear, oh, that's, quote, good enough for rural America if it's a second-class speed. I don't buy that. I think people in rural America ought to have access to the same quality broadband that people in urban America have. And I think our public policies in the Farm Bill should pursue that as well.
So let's talk about existing policy in place. What about the ReConnect program?
The ReConnect program is a program run through the Department of Agriculture. It's a good program. It's been around for about 5 years. It's never been part of the Farm Bill, because the last Farm Bill was done 5 years ago, and ReConnect was created after that. It's subject to the annual appropriations process in Congress, and we all know that that process in Congress is not running smoothly these days. So I think the ReConnect should be part of where it's established in the Farm Bill. I think that makes it a program that people have some certainty it's going to be there over time. And that's the primary vehicle through which the Department of Agriculture funds development of rural broadband. So I think the ReConnect program, it's already had great successes. And by the way, not just for electric cooperatives, telephone cooperatives have also accessed the ReConnect money, and that's a good thing too. Our position is not that electric co-ops have to be the provider of broadband. Our position is everyone in rural America ought to have access to real broadband.
The federal BEAD program announcing recently $42.5 billion to states for rural broadband. What's good about this, and can it help the rural co-ops, or how is it going to help bring service to those who are underserved or not served at all?
Sure. First of all, that's a lot of money. Congress appropriated this money, and as you said, it's going to be distributed through the states. And that's That's good and bad, okay? It's good in the term states get to decide what's going on in their area, and I think that that's, they know their areas better than perhaps folks in Washington, although I think the Department of Agriculture knows rural America real well, as I said earlier, but the states get to decide that. Here's the catch. Some states have got a broadband office up and running, and they're ready to go, and other states don't, and they're just starting up right now, and I don't know if they're going to be ready or not. So there's going to be a patchwork of experience across this country where in some places I predict the BEAD money is going to be deployed really effectively and others where it may not. And so that's a concern I have. But at the end of the day, they're relying on the same maps as the federal government, the FCC maps we talked about earlier, which are better than they were, not as good as we want them to be. And we got to make sure that at the end of the day, there's accountability for where that money goes. So, look. $42.5 billion is a lot of money, and if that moves the needle to help rural America, I'm all for it. But in terms of my membership, and we're in 48 different states, every one of those states is going to have their own design and their own program. We've got to figure out if it works or not.
Jim, what regulations are standing in the way of rural co-ops bidding and bringing service to their customers? Ultimately, this is about the existing population, but it's also about the rural population that could be. I doubt that there are many Generation X, Y, or Zers that are going to move into areas where they're underserved. So if rural development is going to take place, then this service has to be available for them.
Now, you've hit the nail right on the head. I will say that the biggest bucket of regulations that is in our way is something I previously mentioned about how difficult it is to get a permit to allow you to build a new asset. Again, it could be a power plant, it could be an electric transmission line. But we have gotten out of control in this country in terms of how much it gets delayed, how multiple agencies don't coordinate with each other, and there's a better way to do it. There really is. Set some time limits, could be what, 1-2 years to do the analysis, and say, that's the end. Thumb up, yes or no, and we move on. That would help all of us with greater certainty, because I'm here to tell you, when it comes to electric or broadband, we're making long-term capital-intensive investments for the future of these communities. This isn't something where you just change your mind every month. We're making long-term commitments. And that permitting process delays things so long, it's very difficult to plan for the future. So if you were to ask me the one set of regulations that are really in the way, it's those, how can you site a facility in the first place to get there? And I just have to say, the way you phrased that question about opportunities for future growth and economic opportunity in rural America, and folks hopefully moving to rural America more, you're right that you got to have reliable, affordable power, but I'll tell you what you really have to also have, you better have real broadband. You can't get economic development in rural America without real broadband. The businesses aren't going to move there, and the people aren't going to move there if they don't have access to it. So I think this is a wonderful opportunity, quite frankly, for rural America. It's a wonderful opportunity if we seize the moment and make sure we have those resources available.
Let's talk about the Treasury's direct-to-pay tax credits. How could that help to bring new technologies to co-ops?
This is an interesting issue that's developed in the last year, where Congress for years has tried to incentivize investments in newer technologies by offering tax credits, and that's all fine and well, except when you're a non-for-profit electric cooperative, you know, there's no incentive, right? We appreciate we're non-for-profit and tax-exempt, but when it comes to new technology, we don't have those same economic incentives to invest in those technologies. Congress recognized that and said, okay, we're going to create a direct pay mechanism through the Department of Treasury for folks who are non-for-profit, where they get the same economic incentive as the for-profit companies. So that helps electric cooperatives. It also helps all the municipal utilities in America that are non-for-profit. So I can tell you right now, one place where there's a big tax incentive is if you want to build at a coal plant a carbon capture and sequestration type facility to capture carbon, there's all kinds of tax incentives for the for-profit utilities. Now co-ops have access to those same incentives for that new technology. So this is an exciting development where Congress rightfully understood the electric cooperatives have been left without a seat at the table when it comes to having opportunities to invest in new technology. And we all know new technology is evolving and creating better opportunities for America, and it's important co-ops have access to those same economic incentives. So this is going to be one where we can sit down 10, 15 years from now and look back and say, yep, that change in policy really did open up a whole new suite of investments for electric co-ops that have made their communities a better place.
What challenges are you seeing from the Department of Energy's transformer replacement rule?
Well, this is part of an issue where, you know, every sector of the economy is facing some supply chain challenges. That kind of has happened over the last 2 or 3 years, and the electric sector is no different. And one of the basic nuts and bolts tools of providing electricity to people is these things, these electric, they're called distribution transformers. They're those, you know, they're kind of those cylinders that are up on the utility pole that serve a few houses. It's where you're taking the voltage and you're distributing it, you're transferring to lower voltages that go to each house. So that's what a transformer is. Well, guess what? We are needing more and more of those transformers because we're electrifying so much more of our economy. Instead of serving 12 or 15 houses, now you need one for every 8 or 10 houses because everyone's plugging in their iPads and their and everything else. So so there's a shortage in terms of distribution transformers that we already have. And I'm sorry for the long answer, but you asked about what the Department of Energy is doing. They've come up with this, what I think is a horribly timed idea to say, we want to change the standards for transformers of this other type of metal to use to make them, to make them more efficient, and it's going to make the shortage even worse. So we've been very aggressive in pushing back on that with the Department of Energy, saying, even if you think this in the long run is a good idea, this is absolutely the wrong time to be doing this when America is already facing a significant shortage in this type of basic equipment that it takes to run our grid every day. It's not the big, huge power plant we're talking about or the big, huge high-voltage transmission line. These are these things that are in every neighborhood in America. But without them, the system ain't going to work. So I hope the Department of Energy listens to us when we said, withdraw this proposed rule. Don't try to enact a new standard. This is a bad idea.
One of the issues for the nation is labor and adequate labor. Is labor a problem for our rural co-ops?
You know, yes, there's a tight labor situation in this country, and there's kind of a two-edged sword for us. On the one hand, yeah, we face a tighter labor market like everyone else. But I got to tell you something else. Generally, the jobs at the rural co-ops are the best jobs in town. There's long-term stability of the job. Electric co-ops invest in their employees with solid employee benefits. We have a pension plan, by the way. I know there aren't many pension plans out there anymore. We have a defined benefit pension plan that is actuarially sound and fully funded. And so we actually have an ability to maintain our workforce because of the way we treat them and invest in them and their commitment to the rural communities they serve. I'm not going to tell you there aren't some areas where it's hard to hire when you have an open position. Clearly we face that like everybody else. But I just got to say, co-ops are a great place to work. So when it comes to people have a choice between A or B, we think we win in terms of them wanting to go work for a co-op.
Well, Jim Matheson, you have a task indeed of serving so many people across the country, and the strength of our electric co-ops is dependent certainly on so many people. We thank you for your service, and we thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Jim's Open Mic, and you've got the last word today.
Well, I just got to say that in the world of politics these days, where there's a lot of polarization and a lot of rhetoric out there, America's electric co-ops try to approach public policy in a little bit different way. We look at everything through the lens of that individual out of the last person on the line of the electric distribution system, maybe out of the farm that's 6 miles away from everybody else. What do we do to make sure when that guy flips the switch, the light goes on? And what do we also do to make sure that when the bill comes the end of the month, it's an affordable price where he can pay it? And that guides all of our policy views and all of our advocacy. And I think it gives us an interesting perspective and interesting reputation in Washington, D.C., where we may have issues that fall on partisan lines at times. But I'm here to tell you, I strongly believe that everybody in Washington, Republicans, Democrats, they all respect that they know where we're coming from because we're all looking at it through the eyes of the consumer. I think that's a good lesson for all of us to talk about politics these days. Just do the right thing for that person at the end of the line. And generally, those are good politics and good policy, and that's the way we approach our job.
Our thanks to Jim Matheson, CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.